So picture this for a second, right? You walk into a dealership, you sit down at one of those little faux wood desks, and you write a massive check for a piece of heavy machinery.
Like a real big
Oh, a
check.
huge check. Maybe it's like a brand new heavy-duty truck or, I don't know, a high-end agricultural tractor.
Yeah.
So you get the keys, you drive this incredibly expensive 36,000-pound marvel of engineering home, and you park it right in your driveway.
Right.
And you look at it, you know, feeling that deep, tangible pride of ownership. But what if I told you that you don't actually own it?
It sounds crazy.
It sounds completely crazy. But what if, despite the cleared check and the physical title sitting in your filing cabinet,
Yeah.
you are essentially just renting the password to turn it on?
Yeah, and that fundamentally breaks our deeply ingrained cultural understanding of what buying something actually means.
Right, because usually you buy it, it's yours.
Exactly. Since the dawn of commerce, the agreement has been so simple. You buy a physical object, it is yours. End of story. But over the last decade, that physical reality has been quietly, just systematically evaporated by the companies building these machines.
Okay, let's unpack this because we have a really fascinating roadmap for how this happened. We're doing a deep dive today into a recently published April 2026 memo from Timber Outdoor. It was written by their founder, Mike Isaacs, and the title pulls zero punches. It's called You Don't Own It Anymore, You Just Think You Do.
It's a great
It
title.
really sets the stage. So our mission today is to unpack the quiet death of physical ownership, figure out exactly how software has turned buyers into permanent renters, and look at this massive global movement of people who are fighting to reclaim their property.
And we really need to emphasize this up
Yeah,
front.
go ahead.
If you're listening to this right now thinking, well, I don't own a heavy truck or a combine harvester, so this doesn't affect me, you really need to think again. The architecture of control we're talking about today, it extends to almost everything sitting in your driveway or on your desk or even in your kitchen right now.
Seriously, your fridge is probably spying on you.
It probably is. But the heavy machinery sector is just the most glaring, high-stakes testing ground for this new reality. When we talk about tractors and trucks, the financial and physical scales are so massive that the underlying mechanics of consumer control just become impossible to ignore.
To really wrap our heads around how absurd this shift is, imagine buying a physical hardcover book. But every single time you want to turn to chapter two, you have to pause, wait for the publisher to dispatch an authorized employee to your living room, and like have them physically flip the page for you.
Oh, man.
That is essentially what we are talking about here, just scaled up to 36,000-pound vehicles. And their memo highlights this rancher out in the American West who runs his operation with two trucks. One is 40 years old, and the other is brand new.
Yeah, that comparison is wild.
The contrast between them is basically the entire story of modern ownership.
It really is, because with the 40-year-old truck, the rancher starts the engine with a physical metal key. A key that costs, what, about $5 to cut at the local hardware store?
Basically nothing, yeah.
Right. And that key functions perfectly, whether it's a sunny afternoon or literally 40 degrees below zero. When a part on that truck breaks because, friction and gravity eventually conquer all machines, he diagnoses the problem himself using a wrench and a paper manual.
And he doesn't have to go begging the original manufacturer for permission to fix it. He can just order replacement parts from dozens of different independent third-party aftermarket suppliers who have been machining those exact components for decades.
Exactly. He gets the part, spends a Saturday under the hood, and the truck is back hauling feed by Sunday morning.
He fully expects that 40-year-old rig to still be running in the year 2075. But then you look at the new truck parked right next to it. It's an absolute marvel. It tows 36,000 pounds like it's pulling a feather. It rides like a luxury sedan.
But when something goes wrong under that hood, the wrench is utterly useless.
Completely useless.
Because the failure is no longer strictly mechanical, or I guess to be precise, the mechanical failure has been deliberately locked behind a cryptographic wall.
So it's basically a digital lock.
Exactly. When that new truck breaks down, the rancher's only option is to wait. He waits for an authorized dealer, he waits for a specialized technician wielding a laptop loaded with proprietary diagnostic software.
Which he doesn't have access to.
Nope. In this modern paradigm, the physical machine is no longer the core product being sold. The steel, the glass, the engine that is merely the physical entry point to a software lease. Basically, the software is the truck.
And we see this playing out with devastating consequences in the agricultural sector because time isn't just money there. You know, time is survival. There's this story in the source material of a Midwest farmer operating right in the middle of his crucial, really narrow planting window.
Oh, this one is rough.
It is. Mm-hmm. His combine harvester throws an error code and just totally shuts down. It ends up sitting in a dealer's lot 100 miles away. And here's the kicker. They weren't waiting on a physical gear or a belt to be shipped from some warehouse.
No, they had the part.
The physical part was sitting right there on the desk. They were waiting because they needed an authorized technician to plug in a computer and digitally unlock the system. That farmer lost 28 days of his planting season just waiting for a digital handshake.
28 days.
And companies like John Deere and Ford, they are explicitly cited in the memo as the ones actively building this reality.
Think about the mechanics of that digital handshake for a moment, because it isn't just a metaphor. Inside that physical part is an actual microchip. When you install it, that chip has to send a cryptographic ping to the tractor's main computer.
Like it's asking for permission.
Exactly. The main computer then checks that specific serial number against a remote server owned by the manufacturer. If the server doesn't send back an explicit authorization code, the tractor's computer treats that brand new, perfectly fine physical part as a foreign object and just refuses to engage the engine.
Okay, but wait, let me push back a little here. Isn't this just the inevitable price of progress? I mean, if we demand a truck that drives like a supercomputer on wheels, navigating complex emission standards and towing massive loads at the push of a button, you can't really expect it to be fixed with a rusty wrench.
Mm.
Doesn't complex performance inherently require complex software?
It absolutely does require complex software to manage those tasks, but that is, that's conflating two very different things.
How so?
Well, the problem isn't the presence of the software running the fuel injectors. The problem is who holds the administrative keys to that software. Manufacturers aren't just using technology to manage the engine anymore. They are using it to manage you, the owner.
Oh, I see. And the data on this is wild. If you look at the automotive recall statistics from 2024 and 2025, it paints a pretty bleak picture of what happens when you turn a car into a rolling computer network.
What's fascinating here is how the recall data proves this is a structural vulnerability, not just a few localized bugs. Like, in 2025, one major American automaker set an all-time industry record by issuing 153 separate recalls in a single year.
153 in 1 year. That's insane.
It's massive. And if we look at the broader industry in 2024, out of 28.9 million total recalled vehicles, an astonishing 46% were recalled specifically due to software issues.
Wow.
Yeah, that was an 80% surge from just the year prior, where software only accounted for 14% of recalls.
So it's escalating rapidly, like really rapidly.
Exponentially. Because when you design a 36,000-pound physical machine that relies entirely on centralized software to function, a single line of bad code sent through an over-the-air update can instantaneously ground a million vehicles.
Boom, done.
Right. And because the manufacturer retains exclusive encrypted control over that code, the owner has zero recourse but to surrender their vehicle back to the dealership network that sold them the faulty product to begin with.
Which brings us to the concept of brain dead parts. And I gotta say, this might be the most maddening part of this whole ecosystem.
Oh, absolutely.
If you were listening to this and you've ever had an independent repair shop fix your car, just imagine this scenario. Your new truck breaks down. You know exactly what's wrong. A specific computer module got fried. So you tow it to your trusted local mechanic who has kept your family's cars running for 20 years.
Someone you actually trust.
Exactly. They order a brand new manufacturer original replacement module. They unbolt the dead one. They bolt in the new one, plug in all the wires perfectly. They turn the key and absolutely nothing happens.
Because that replacement part arrives completely inert. It is legally and functionally brain dead.
Which is just wild to think about.
For that new, physically perfect module to communicate with the rest of the truck, it must be paired to the vehicle's unique VIN. And the only way to facilitate that pairing is by using the manufacturer's proprietary diagnostic software.
Software that they won't give to anyone else.
Right. Software that the manufacturer flat out refuses to sell to anyone outside of their official franchise dealer network.
So if an independent mechanic is completely locked out of activating the very parts they are installing, they are effectively legislated out of business. I mean, they can't complete the repair.
Yeah.
The consumer is forcibly funneled back into the dealership service bays, allowing the manufacturer to completely monopolize the repair market. What happens to the entire ecosystem of independent repair shops that communities have relied on for generations?
They get starved out. And that existential threat to independent businesses and consumer rights is exactly why regulators are finally stepping into the ring. The legal pushback is becoming massive.
Yeah, they're not taking it lying down anymore.
Not at all. In early 2025, a coalition of federal regulators and state attorneys general filed a $4.2 billion antitrust lawsuit against a major equipment manufacturer. The core allegation is exactly what we just described, illegally monopolizing repair services.
And that's headed for trial in 2026, right?
Yes, exactly.
There was also a parallel class action settlement recently that really highlights the sheer disrespect these companies have for their customers. The manufacturer proposed a settlement offering over 200,000 qualifying farmers a total payout of $79 million.
Which theoretically compensates them for 8 years of restricted access to their own equipment.
Right. And $79 million sounds like a big number to put on a press release, right?
Until you look at the actual distribution of those funds.
Exactly. The lawyers who negotiated the settlement walked away with $20 million off the top. When you take the remainder and divide it among the actual farmers and the acreage they work, the payout comes out to 79 cents per acre.
Just unbelievable.
We are talking about farmers who lost entire harvest cycles, who paid thousands of dollars to tow their equipment hundreds of miles back and forth to dealerships just to get a diagnostic scan they weren't allowed to run themselves. And the compensation for almost a decade of that nightmare is 79 cents an acre.
It's insulting.
It was so insulting that one agricultural advocate started wearing a literal 79 cents sticker to all of his press appearances just to highlight the absurdity of it.
Because it functions as a corporate hush money payment. It's a check written specifically to make a PR crisis disappear without requiring the company to alter their underlying software architecture.
Right, they didn't actually fix the problem.
Not at all. And the depth of that systemic control becomes painfully obvious when you look at the diagnostic tools themselves.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because there isn't just one version of the diagnostic software. If a farmer pays thousands of dollars for the official, premium, owner-facing diagnostic software and plugs their laptop into their million-dollar combine, the system provides this carefully curated, limited view.
Yeah, they hold back the good stuff.
Exactly. Crucially, certain factory-mandated product improvement programs are completely hidden from the owner. But if you unplug that laptop, hand it to a dealer technician who logs in with dealer-level credentials and plug it back into the exact same port on the exact same tractor, suddenly, all of those hidden diagnostic codes and improvement programs materialize on the screen.
So you spend $1.2 million on a piece of equipment, you pay for the premium diagnostic subscription, and you are still intentionally blinded to the reality of your own machine.
It's madness. So what happens when people's livelihoods are on the line and the legal system offers them 79 cents? They get desperate.
Of course they do.
During harvest season, a farmer might only have a 48-hour window of perfect weather to get an entire year's worth of crops out of the ground before a storm ruins them.
Yeah.
If the combine bricks itself because of a sensor error, they cannot wait 2 weeks for a dealer technician to arrive.
They lose everything.
Everything. So these honest, hardworking agricultural business owners are turning into tractor hackers. They're going onto dark web forums and sourcing pirated, cracked diagnostic software from Eastern Europe just so they can force their own legally purchased equipment to run.
It represents a profound systemic failure when you force legitimate business owners into a gray market of international software piracy simply to maintain sovereignty over their own physical property.
But wait, this is where the legal mechanics get incredibly confusing to me. Didn't the U.S. government already step in and explicitly allow farmers to do this?
They did, yep.
Because I know the Library of Congress granted an official exemption to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA, specifically so farmers could bypass these digital locks. Mm-hmm. How is this still a problem? How does a corporate terms of service agreement effectively overrule a federal copyright exemption?
This raises such an important question about how modern copyright law interacts with physical goods. It sounds bizarre that the Library of Congress is involved in tractor repair.
Yeah, it really does.
But they house the U.S. Copyright Office. Because the software running the tractor is considered copyrighted code, physically breaking the digital lock to fix your machine was technically classified as a federal copyright crime under the DMCA.
Which is crazy.
So the Library of Congress reviewed this and essentially ruled, okay, farmers, you will no longer face federal copyright charges or prison time for hacking your tractor for the explicit purpose of repair.
Okay, so that sounds like a win. But the manufacturers didn't just accept that, did they?
Not at all. They bypass the spirit of the ruling entirely by exploiting a massive legal loophole, which is contract law.
Oh, of course.
They simply updated their end-user license agreements, you know, those massive walls of text you click agree to when you turn on a device. They stated that while the government might not prosecute you for copyright infringement, breaking the digital lock is a violation of their corporate terms of service.
Wow. So they just route around the government.
Yep. So if you do it, they legally reserve the right to instantaneously void your entire warranty, refuse to sell you any future replacement parts, and permanently blacklist your machine's serial number from their dealer network.
That's terrifying for a business owner.
Exactly. The federal exemption exists on paper, but the threat of absolute corporate retaliation makes it practically unusable for a farmer who still needs to buy parts next year.
Which begs the question, why? Why are these corporations fighting so incredibly hard, spending millions on lobbyists and lawyers, to maintain this iron-fisted control over a tractor that has already been sold? I mean, have you seen what's happening with modern trucks and ICE?
Oh, the soy-based wiring insulation, yes. This is a perfect illustration of the disconnect between design and reality.
It is so wild. So over the last several years, multiple auto manufacturers switched the protective insulation wrapped around their wiring harnesses from petroleum-based plastics to soy-based materials. On paper, in a corporate boardroom, this looks brilliant. It's cheaper to manufacture, and it looks fantastic on corporate environmental sustainability reports. But out in the real world, there is a massive flaw.
Rodents.
Rodents think the soy wiring is delicious. Mites, rats, and squirrels are literally crawling up into the engine bays and eating the wiring harnesses out of brand new trucks. We're talking about vehicles that have been parked in the exact same spots on rural farms for decades without a single issue, suddenly being totally disabled because a mouse ate the main computer cable.
And naturally, when owners take these destroyed vehicles back to the dealership, the manufacturers deny that the soy-based wiring constitutes a design flaw.
Even though the mice love it.
Right. They refuse to cover the thousands of dollars in damage under warranty despite mounting class action lawsuits. But the rancher in our source material offers a really brilliant analysis of what this actually signifies about the manufacturer's true motives. It's not just about cheap wiring, it's about the life cycle of the product.
Right, the Nevada carburetor theory. The rancher points out that if a manufacturer builds a rugged mechanical truck that easily lasts 100 years, that is a fantastic outcome for the independent aftermarket.
Yep.
It is great for this one supplier in Nevada who has been reliably churning out physical replacement carburetors since 1987. It's great for local junkyards, and it is great for the independent mechanics.
But it's bad for the original brand.
Terrible for them.
Yeah.
A truck that lasts a century is a financial nightmare for the original manufacturer's exclusive parts monopoly. They don't see a single dime of that aftermarket revenue for the next 90 years.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the natural, ruthless evolution of an economic strategy that began a century ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, back in the 1920s, General Motors institutionalized the concept of planned obsolescence. They introduced the idea of the annual model change, altering the shape of the tail fins, changing the headlights. The goal wasn't necessarily to engineer a machine that physically broke down faster. It was to engineer a consumer culture rooted in continuous replacement.
Make the old one look uncool.
Exactly. They use styling to make you feel like your perfectly functional 3-year-old car was embarrassingly out of date.
So essentially, planned obsolescence used to be a psychological trick, making you feel like your old car was obsolete. But today, it has evolved into a literal digital cage. They no longer have to spend millions on marketing to convince you to upgrade your equipment. They simply refuse to give you the cryptographic keys required to fix the one you already have.
They control the lifespan of the machine by controlling the software.
And the environmental irony of this strategy is just staggering, especially when you look at the outdoor and agricultural industries.
So true.
Brands will preach sustainability. They'll boast about their soy-based wiring or their carbon offset programs. But they willfully ignore the most fundamental law of ecological conservation. The most environmentally friendly, sustainable vehicle on the planet is the one that has already been built.
Yes. Timber Outdoors memo hammers this point home so well. When you give an owner the tools to keep a 40-year-old truck running, you are bypassing the catastrophic environmental toll of producing a brand new one.
You save all those resources.
Completely. You avoid the massive ecological impact of raw material extraction, the intensive mining for rare earth metals, the smelting of steel, the global cargo ship transport of thousands of individual components, and the immense energy consumed by the factory before that new truck ever drives its first mile.
A machine designed from the ground up to be repaired indefinitely is a machine with an indefinite lifespan, which fundamentally recontextualizes this entire debate. Digital lockout is not merely a niche consumer rights dispute or a localized agricultural headache. It is intrinsically a climate crisis issue.
Exactly. The global climate movement and the right to repair movement are natural, inextricably linked allies.
But there is light at the end of the tunnel here. The resistance against this digital cage isn't just a handful of angry guys with wrenches anymore. It is highly organized, and the momentum is actively shifting globally.
The landscape has changed dramatically in just the last few years. We are seeing major legislative breakthroughs. In late 2024, Canada passed landmark legislation that finally provides real legal teeth.
Which is huge.
It is. It allows farmers to bypass digital locks specifically for the purpose of repair without the threat of corporate retaliation. Over in Australia, the National Farmers Federation spent years acting in good faith, trying to negotiate voluntary right-to-repair agreements with the major manufacturers.
And how did that go?
Well, when the manufacturers stalled and those talks went nowhere, the NFF pivoted hard. They are now actively demanding binding, aggressive federal legislation from the Australian government.
Good for them. And the pressure is mounting here in the U.S. as well. Over a dozen states have introduced their own agricultural right-to-repair bills. And that $4.2 billion antitrust lawsuit we talked about earlier, a federal judge explicitly refused the manufacturer's motion to dismiss it. Yeah. These companies are going to have to open their books and face the music in open court. But a lot of this progress wouldn't be possible without the advocates doing the incredibly tedious, highly technical heavy lifting behind the scenes.
Organizations like the Digital Right to Repair Coalition, USPRG, and particularly iFixit have been instrumental.
I love iFixit.
They're great. iFixit is the largest online repair community in the world, but their real power lies in their physical teardowns. When a new device or tractor component comes out, they literally tear it apart, map the circuitry, and document the specific DRM chips that enforce these software locks.
So they get the actual receipts.
Exactly. They take that irrefutable physical evidence directly to lawmakers to prove exactly how these companies are restricting repair.
It's incredible work.
Yeah.
And it's catching the attention of organizations way above the state level. The World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, is now officially treating the right to repair as a serious international IP policy issue.
Yeah, that is a massive paradigm shift. When WIPO steps in, it elevates the conversation from a localized warranty dispute to the level of international treaty interpretation.
That's the big leagues.
It is. It represents a global acknowledgement that using copyright law to prevent a farmer from replacing a fuel injector is a gross distortion of what intellectual property protections were originally designed to do.
So with all of this global momentum, the lawsuits, the legislation, the international scrutiny, and with companies like Timber Outdoor publicly promising in their upcoming Memo 004 to build products differently from day one, to prioritize absolute repairability, are we actually at a tipping point? Are manufacturers finally going to be forced by the sheer weight of public and legal pressure to hand the keys back to the owners?
We are undoubtedly closer to a genuine tipping point than we have been since the invention of the microchip. I mean, these manufacturers are not going to surrender a highly lucrative, monopolized revenue stream willingly.
They'll fight it.
But the convergence of intense consumer outrage, undeniable environmental necessity, and rapidly tightening legal frameworks is creating a pressure cooker that they cannot contain forever.
So what does this all mean? If we look back at the ground we've covered today, the core takeaway is that the very definition of ownership has been quietly hijacked while we were distracted by the convenience of push-button technology.
We traded ownership for convenience.
We did. It transitioned from a tangible, physical reality where a $5 piece of cut metal guarantees your truck starts into a temporary, highly conditional software lease governed by unseen corporate servers. But the fight is far from over. From desperate farmers downloading rogue software in the dead of night to harvest their crops, to federal judges upholding multi-billion dollar antitrust lawsuits, people are actively, aggressively fighting to reclaim the wrench.
And as we consider the stakes of that fight, I really want to leave you with one critical vulnerability in this modern architecture that we haven't explicitly named yet.
What's that?
This entire paradigm of control relies entirely on perpetual connectivity. If your ability to use a physical 36,000-pound machine relies 100% on a remote corporate server constantly authenticating a digital subscription, what happens when that manufacturer goes bankrupt? Or what happens if, 5 years from now, a new CEO simply decides that maintaining the authentication servers for an older model tractor is no longer profitable and they unplug them? Without those servers alive to provide the necessary digital handshake, does our entire physical world just become a graveyard of permanently bricked steel?
That is a deeply unsettling thought to leave on, but an incredibly necessary one. Next time you sit down at a desk to write a massive check for something sitting in a driveway, ask yourself, are you actually buying a machine or are you just renting a password? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep asking the hard questions, and we'll catch you next time.